This is Afternoon New Music on WKCR FM New York and WKCR HD1 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Bill Dougherty. Today I'm joined on the phone by Thomas Steenland, founder and executive director of Starkland Records, in celebration of recent releases of a new CD of works by American accordionist, composer, and improviser Guy Klusevic, and also the soon-to-be-released album of American composer Todd Dockstader, From the Archives, featuring never-before-heard compositions discovered on Todd Dockstader's computer after his death last year. As executive director of Starkland Records, Tom has over four decades of experience in the recording business and has released dozens of albums presenting world premiere recordings of over 160 works by more than 80 composers, some of whom include Charles Amerkanyan, Martin Bresnik, Fred Frith, Kirill McCann, Ingram Marshall, Meritz Bau, Pauline Oliveros, and John Zorn, to name a few. Such ensembles as ICE, the International Contemporary Ensemble, the Kronos Quartet, the Jack Quartet, the Either Or Ensemble, and the Janacek Philharmonic Orchestra have all been featured on Starkland's CDs. You can find Starkland's recordings distributed by Naxos of America, and they're available at all your online retailers, Amazon, iTunes, and Spotify. So thank you so much for joining us today, Tom.
I'm pleased to be here. Thank you.
How did you get involved in championing alternative, classical, experimental, and avant-garde music, firstly?
Well, it started about 40 years ago when I was a graduate student at the University of Colorado, and one of my professors, Cecil Effinger, had the idea, which is radical at the time, that a record label could be a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. That essentially had never been done. There were a few narrowly defined labels that were tax-exempt, but none that were just broadly defined to release a wide variety of new music. So he spent about 2 years with the IRS. The IRS never heard of such a thing. They kept on turning it down. They said, you're releasing commercial recordings, so how can you be nonprofit? But the analogy, of course, is that it's like a symphony today or an art museum, and all of this was radical at the time. It's very common today. Anyway, he succeeded, and they got the tax-exempt status, and the label at that point was called Owl Recording, Inc., and they sort of thought that, well, now that we've done the hard work, we've got the 501c3 status, everything is just going to work out. The money is going to flow in, the recordings will be made. But it didn't quite work that way. They were just people on the board that did this, but they didn't really have anyone to actually work on the projects. And when I heard about this, I thought it was a fantastic potential. And so I expressed interest, and they gradually let me do more and more stuff. And eventually, I became executive director of Owl Recording and pretty much did everything. So that's where I got started.
Okay. And were you coming from a musical background?
Yes, I was studying as a grad student composition at CU, and also CU and University of Colorado in Denver has a recording engineering program. So I also studied recording engineering down there. And the whole process of putting out recordings and putting out recordings of new music was pretty intoxicating to me. So it seemed like a natural fit to begin doing that. And it was over those years with Al that I essentially learned everything about releasing new music and these were LPs way back then. So I learned about getting cover art and liner notes and sales and distribution and recording studio sessions and promotion and all of that. So that's where I acquired a lot of knowledge over 15 years with Al.
I'd be interested, how did they, so I understand the claim of the you know, we're kind of a arts organization, we're a museum. How did they finally convince the IRS that they weren't going to be turning a profit? Was it just running the label for a bit and saying, see how much money we're not making?
Well, no, they had to determine that beforehand. And so some of the conditions were projects that were inherently not commercial, which of course new music is, and also that they would not compete with existing recordings. They wouldn't duplicate something that was already out there. And part of it also was a condition that they would distribute the LPs for free to a wide variety of sources to gain exposure. So at that time, I remember we had a large list of music libraries around the country. So we would not only send out the LPs to radio stations and critics and so forth, but we'd send out like 100 to music libraries all over the country to sort of fulfill our mission of being tax exempt.
Right. And then were you also getting into the music at this time, or had you been listening to kind of alternative experimental music prior to getting into recording?
Well, naturally, I have been listening to a wide variety of music as I was studying composition. And when I took over Al was an existing company that was about to go out of business, and that was what prompted to resurrect it as a tax-exempt label. So when I took over, the first thing I did was familiarize myself with all their recordings. And it was a highly eclectic collection of recordings. There were local folk music groups. There were steam engine recordings. There was a guy who played the musical saw.
Wow, love the musical saw.
Yeah, his claim, he was on Johnny Carson at one point, so that was a big deal. And amongst all these recordings, there were four LPs from Todd Dockstader, who I didn't know of at that point, so I listened to them, and I thought that they were extraordinary. And so I became a fan, and I actually, when I took over, I sent out the LPs again to get new exposure and got some more reviews for them at that point. This is music that was all recorded in 1963, 64, 65, and it was around that time that the older Al had released it. And I, from then on, started to try and get more exposure for it.
Wow. So really it was just that you heard this music on a LP from Al Records where you were working and said, who is this Todd Dockstader? How come I haven't heard of him? How can I hear more? How does he get more attention? It's really, what was it about the music that kind of spoke to you?
Well, it was distinctive and powerful. It was not academic style music. It didn't use synthesizers. He was turned down once at the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Center. It was just by instinct, and the sounds were really rich. It was beautifully organized, and it was powerful. So I thought, this is fantastic, and that led to a bunch of things, including one of the reasons I started Starkland, which is kind of another story, but...
Yeah, so Starkland was created in the 90s, right? And its sole kind of mission at first was to reissue recordings of Todd Dockstader, right?
Yes, well, several things happened around 1990. I had been doing Al for all those years, and what I learned that in terms of funding the recordings, that in order to get funding, the composers had to have certain credentials. And those credentials essentially meant at that time that they were associated with the university.
And he wasn't.
The university might... Right, and he wasn't. But all of those recordings that I put out with Al, they all came with funding, say, a university supporting a composer or a composer who could get grants. But typically to get grants, you had to be associated with the university or have won some major prizes, which generally were awarded to academic people. So it meant that with Al, there was sort of a narrow aesthetic range of music that the finances sort of dictated. So that was one factor. And along with that, I was aware in the 1980s of the huge alternative scene that was developing in what was then called downtown, literally coming from downtown Manhattan. And there are people like Philip Glass and Steve Reich and Lamont Young. And this was an exciting scene to me, and that was very interesting music. It had a whole kind of appeal to a broader range of the public than the academic style music, but Al was sort of excluded from releasing that, and I was interested in getting involved with that. And then the third reason that I started Starkland was, well, that was the point where LPs were being phased out and CDs were about to clearly taking over. And the Todd Dockstetter LPs had sold out. There was really no chance of reissuing them on CD because overall there wasn't the money available, and all of Al's catalog was LPs at that point. So suddenly, I can't quite explain it, but I think I was out jogging one day and it all came together. It hit me that what I should do is start my own label, issue CDs, explore downtown alternative music, and the first two CDs would be reissuing all of Todd's classic pieces on CD and getting them new exposure.
And so how do you go about, so did you have, were you just being a recording engineer? How are you getting kind of a funding source to even put this together? Or was it all fundraising? Did you have a day job? Or was this like full time?
Well, it was a combination of things. To a certain degree, I put in some seed money of my own for the Dockstetter releases. And you have to remember, it was sort of a big risk because we didn't know what would happen. I mean, when I approached Todd, he was very skeptical because the music at that point was maybe 25 years old. The technology had changed tremendously, and he was worried that it wouldn't come across so well. But I sort of convinced him because CDs have a much better audio quality. They can put out something that essentially is equivalent to what he heard in the recording studio, whereas on the LPs they had to be compromised, especially in the low end, because there's a lot of power in Dockstetter's music from the deep lows and you have to roll them off to produce an LP, whereas in the CDs they could be there. So, and then he also had a few other unreleased pieces, so all those reasons helped me convince him to allow me to reissue those, but I was sort of taking a chance, and it turned out to be, well, a huge success. I mean, there are like over 30 reviews, and one of the first reviews was in the Washington Post that praised him extensively, and the Wire magazine, which was a major alternative magazine at the time and still is important today, they gave it a rave review. So I sort of have both sides of the fence. And that really put Starkland on the map. I mean, they sold well, they got great reviews. And what that also set me up for then was that when I came out with future releases, people would pay attention because the Dockstetter releases were so significant. So that's how I got started.
And so was this a full-time gig for you?
Yes. Yeah, it was full-time because I essentially did, I mean, over the years, especially, I did everything. I mean, I eventually did all the graphic design. I did the mastering. I did, you know, all the promotion and handling sales and distribution. And I did everything.
Right. So, yes. And no staff either?
No, just me.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So a full-time job.
Oh, yeah.
And so in the soon-to-be-released album featuring never-before-heard compositions of Todd Dockstetter, I understand you went through his computer after he passed away last year and kind of hand-picked certain sound files from a whole trove of sound files on his computer for this record. Is that right? And
yes. And one thing I'd like to mention is that naturally this brings me back to the origins of Starkland, but one of the positive aspects of the original Dockstetter releases was that he was re-inspired to put a lot more energy back into composing because of all the positive reviews, and that led him to spend a lot of time, and that eventually resulted in all this material that I'm now releasing. So it's a very satisfying full circle or completing the arc type of situation.
Right, that you didn't wait too. You didn't wait too long. He was still alive and kind of young enough, quote unquote, to to be re-inspired to write more, right? Because he was
So he kept on writing more, and he had some releases come out on another label, but he put together a lot more material than what was released. And when he died last year, they discovered on his computer something like 4,200 sound files. And a devoted fan, Justin Brierley, had worked with Todd's daughter, and he initially went through all those, took a huge amount of time and sort of characterized them. Because some things were samples or rejects or something. But then there were other things that were cryptically labeled like Final Four CD. And that implied that he thought that those might be ready. We had to sort of guess what was appropriate, because there'd be Final Four CD, and then there'd be Final Four CD 2, and then there would be several versions of the same. So Justin narrowed that down to about 50 potential pieces. He sent those to me. We went over it, and then we settled on the 15 pieces that are on the CD, and we feel pretty confident that they're solid representations of what he would do, and that they're fully completed or 95% completed. It was important to me not to release fragments or things that weren't polished or things that weren't done. That just didn't seem ethically right to do that. I only wanted to release pieces that really reflected Todd at his best, because he was such a perfectionist, he would never want incomplete stuff to go out. And fortunately, there was enough to make a CD.
So I watched bits and pieces of a kind of fledgling documentary called Unlocking Dockstader that I guess has lost its funding or something
Yes, well, that was the same person, Justin, and that's how originally his interest, he had a radio show, and he wanted to contact Dockstader in, I guess this was the mid-2000s, and he contacted me, and I put him in touch with Dockstader's daughter, Tina. But at that point, unfortunately, Todd was in the early stages of Alzheimer's, and he wasn't doing so well, and he stopped composing around then. But Justin contacted him and got some interviews with him that were a little bit coherent, and then Justin developed the idea of he'd like to do a film, but it's pretty ambitious to do a film, and he was not able to secure funding, and the recent film video of Dockstader was not that usable because of Todd's unfortunate condition. So that's sort of a stalled project at that point. But that's how he became involved with kind of becoming Todd's archivist.
Well, there was some really touching footage of Todd listening to a piece and being really kind of excited by it. And then saying, "Wow, I don't know who this was, but they really were really amazing. That whatever they did there was just fantastic." They say, "Oh, was you who did that." No, you don't say. And he looks a genuine surprise over his face.
He was not. His memory wasn't so good, but he would sometimes he would sort of be out of it, I think, when Justin was there. But when music came up or he played music, then Todd's mind would sort of freshen up and sort of click in, and at least he'd become interested in the music. So those interviews are interesting. They're poignant and they're sort of sad, but they show some spark of what he once was.
Right. And so the pieces that are going to be released here in November, do you know, are any of those from kind of the time when he started to battle Alzheimer's, or is it all prior?
It's all prior to that. The date of the pieces are around, say, 2007, 2006, and they were when he was fine then, and basically he stopped composing when the Alzheimer's started to kick in, so there isn't music after his mental capabilities, you know, degenerated some. So all this was still when he was fully at his prime, I would say.
And so what's going to happen now to the other 4,100 and, you know, whatever, 180 sound files? I know you said a bunch of them are just kind of bits and bobs, but I imagine there's other files on there that say final version
well,
4 or whatever.
I think we hit most of the final versions. There were several different versions of the same piece, and we had to exercise our judgment as to which one we thought was best. And a lot of those were just samples that he was gathering, so a lot could be eliminated. There is some alternative project I've heard something about where they're going to release incomplete pieces and various versions of some pieces, and I know that Justin's looking into that also. That was something I was not interested in doing, but there may be someone else that would like to hear even incomplete fragments of Doc Setter's work. So I'm not really sure what's going to happen with the rest of that. But that's inherent with any composer. Any composer passes away, there's going to be leftover stuff that's not complete. And often it seems appropriate to, unless you're Beethoven or something, it seems appropriate to not release it. So that was my viewpoint.
Yeah, I think there's, Nietzsche's diaries were released, I think, at the end of his life by his sister or something. Maybe I'm making this up. Well, I know that something along these lines happened where a family member, trying to get a little bit of money at the end of his life, released his diaries when he had kind of also was suffering mental illness towards the end of his life. And there's always kind of been questions around, you know, the morality of doing such a thing, of releasing something that he may have not wanted to be seen.
Yeah, I was very sensitive to that because in working with Todd over the years, I knew he was such a perfectionist about sound, and he worked so hard to shape pieces exactly the way he wanted that it didn't feel right to me to represent things that were incomplete. So I feel confident that what's on this CD will come across as strong, powerful music and will sound complete and polished and finished.
Great. So why don't we turn now to a track off of the new album, and you can pick one and introduce it.
The first track, Super Choral, would be an excellent choice. It's just about 3 minutes, but you immediately sense the power of what's going on, and also you have to think about this was a guy that was maybe 75 years old at the time. He started out in the 50s cutting sound for film, and that's where he learned about shaping sound. And then his classic works in the 60s were under very crude conditions. I mean, there were just stereo recordings. There were no effects units. And he didn't use synthesizers. I mean, there weren't synthesizers really then. So I think when you hear this new music, it's astonishing how much he progressed and yet still retained his innate sense of drama and power.
Great. So let's listen to that now. And what's the title again?
It's the first Super Choral. There are several interlinking titles, like the last piece on the main part of the CD, track 14, is also Choral Mix. So we kind of put together, there's a little bit of a sense of structure in the overall tracking, sequencing order of it in terms of linking pieces. But Super Choral is the first track, and I think worthwhile hearing.
Thank you.
So that was Todd Dockstader's Super Choral off of a release coming up in November off of Starkland Records, a release of previously unheard recordings of Todd Dockstader's music that were taken from his computer after he passed away last year. I'm here today speaking with Thomas Steenland, founder and executive director of Starkland Records, in celebration of the recent release of a new CD of works by American accordionist, composer, and improviser Guy Klusevic, and also, as I said, the soon-to-be-released album of American composer Todd Dockstader, one of the pieces we were just listening to there. So, Tom, moving forward, I'm interested... So maybe we can talk a bit about Guy Klusevic and how you got interested in his works.
Well, there are a wide variety of ways that I begin to learn about music, and usually it comes up through some type of personal contact. I mean, I get sent things a lot of time out of the blue, but often those aren't appropriate for us. But in this case, going back a long time ago, I'd read about Guy, and he seemed like he was pretty interesting, but I hadn't heard his music. So it turned out that at one point at the University of Colorado here in Boulder, he gave a concert. And it was not even sponsored with the music department. I think some dance organization put it on because a lot of his music is used in connection with dance. So I went and I heard him play, and I thought it was extraordinary. He's an amazing musician. The compositions are interesting. They're very accessible, but always with a twist that lets you know this is something being composed today, not just straightforward, say, folk music or something. So afterwards, I introduced myself and said how much I admired his playing and his compositions, and we struck up a friendship, and that continues strongly to this day. At this point, this is now my fourth Guy Klusevic release. They've all been great. I mean, the music is great. He's worked with a lot of interesting composers that he's commissioned music from, people like John Zorn and Aaron J. Kernis and, well, a whole bunch of people. And this latest CD is all of his own music. And I know I sound like I'm over-promoting, but I would say every track on this is terrific. And when I attended the CD release concert in New York a couple weeks ago at Spectrum, he played most of the pieces from the CD, and there was big warm applause for every piece because they came across so beautifully. And a part of what makes this especially wonderful is that on many of the pieces, he plays with the violinist Todd Reynolds, who is a wonderful violinist, and the two of them play together. I don't know what it is, but some kind of magic happens. They just tune into each other, they play well, and it's a wonderful experience to listen to them.
Great. Do you want to listen now to a track on that album as well?
Sure. There are several different tracks. The one that starts off the CD is certainly appealing, called Moose Mouth Mirror. And Guy is known for his unusual titles. And for the first time at the concert, I actually learned where this title came from. I had no idea, but as they were setting up, Guy explained that he was reading an article about displays at natural history museums and how they display animals. And in order to show some light from inside of an animal's mouth, they would stick a mirror inside the mouth. So he then decided the phrase Moose Mouth Mirror would be an interesting title for a piece.
Well, there you go. So let's turn now and listen to Moose Mouth Mirror. Thank you. So you were just listening to Moose Mouth Mirror by Guy Klusevic, an American-born accordionist and composer, off of a recently released album on Starkland Records. Performing was Guy himself and Todd Reynolds. So I have here joining me today Thomas Steenland, who is the founder and executive director of Starkland Records, that have been active since the 90s in promoting all sorts of wonderful experimental music. They've put out recordings of over 160 works by more than 80 composers, some of whom include Ingram Marshall, Meritz Bau, Meredith Monk, Pauline Oliveros, and even John Zorn, too. And so what I'm wondering in looking at all those names and looking at Todd Dockstader and Guy Klusevic and others, I'm trying to pin down the kind of the aesthetic vision of Starkland Records with a roster as diverse as yours. Fred Frith, another one that's kind of these kind of, I don't know, each one to me seems a bit of an outlier almost. And there's no... It's hard. I wonder what is your aesthetic direction, or is it purely on, well, these people are kind of underrepresented, and so therefore they should be heard.
Well, one thing I pride myself on is that I'm not locked into a certain niche of music. I don't only do, say, post-minimalism or something. I just look for music that is powerful and seems to have something distinctive going on. And sometimes that can be very accessible music, like the music on Guy Klusevic's CD. I think just about anyone would enjoy. It's very pretty and gorgeous. On the other hand, the Elliot Sharp CD I released a couple of years ago, there are a couple of long pieces. They're like 30 minutes long. And I would say that they're challenging to listen to. It's not easy listening. But in listening to them myself, I just sense that there's something special going on. There's something different going on. And I learned with Elliot later on more about how he organizes his pieces, and they are indeed unusual. He uses biogenetics, the Fibonacci series, and mathematical stuff to organize these cells that repeat, but they don't repeat in a normal way. And so I just sense that there's something distinctive, and I would like to see the world learn more about these composers. It's not that I set out to, if a composer, just because a composer is unrecognized, I'd like to bring attention to them. It's something that that I think is worthwhile knowing. And one example would be Philip Bimstein. Long story short, he had studied music some, but his background was in forming a new wave punk band in Chicago. But then he moved to Utah, a small town in Utah, and his neighbor was a farmer named Garland Hershey. So one day Philip went out and said to Garland, "So Garland, why do your cows moo?" And Garland answered the question, and it turned out that Garland had a wonderful way of storytelling. So Philip decided to make a piece about Garland Hershey's cows. And then he had some other pieces. We put out a CD, and it was a big success. I mean, when they play Garland Hershey's cows on the largest radio station, public radio station in San Francisco, they got the second most response ever. They had like 90 phone calls from one airing. And then he went on to have performances at the Kennedy Center and Lincoln Center and London's Royal Opera House. And he got a bunch of commissions because he was doing something different. In the Garland Hershey's Cows piece, he used snippets of Garland speaking and just altered them into rhythmic structures. And then he also created music that mimicked the speech outlines of what Garland was saying. And way back when he did that, that was something fairly new. And so, again, that was an example of something that was really distinctive to me. And also accessible. So I think that was an example of what a small label can do, is that he was virtually unknown in the contemporary classical world, and then he became a big success in that world because of the recording.
And do you think that there's, because looking at what Starkland has put out and what the music you've been interested in over the last 40 years, it seems that you've erred towards the side of American avant-garde music, this kind of steering clear of European composers or the big names in European music. Do you think that there's something, is this because there's something about the American experimental tradition that you find more appealing or feel closer to as a composer yourself?
Well, I think it's just a matter of the composers I end up being in contact with. I attend a number of new music festivals, and typically there are American composers there, and then the composers that are on my label will refer me to other composers, and they tend to also be American composers. It's not that I'm setting out to just do American composers, but it's sort of worked out that way. Also, a big difference between American and European composers is that American composers recognize from the outset that funding is necessary, whereas typically European composers, they have a much different financial system over there. And a lot of times their music that comes out in European labels has funding that's built in from radio stations and other sources. So they're used to funding just being available. So I think the situation of coming to Starkland where some funding is necessary is alien to them. So for a lot of reasons, it's ended up being American composers.
Right. And not only is their thinking have to be perhaps different, but also that there's kind of a hole in the recording arena that is, you know, a German or French or English radio station would fill. And so it's really amazing and a huge service what you do at Starkland Records to fill that kind of missing link of promoting and recording music that otherwise may not ever be commercially released.
Yes, that's right.
So, I mean, it's also in that their kind of aesthetic direction or stylistic thinking, not only is that important, but also that they need you as much as you kind of are interested in them, I guess.
Yes, I think the releases can have major benefits for the composers. It's not that they're going to make a lot of money off of it, but the promotional value is incredible because I will send out 100 to 150 promo copies of each CD, which is way more than makes common sense, and a normal businessman would never do that. But it ends up getting a lot of exposure for them. They typically get reviews, maybe 10 to 20 reviews per CD. Some of them get reviewed in the New York Times, and they end up with quotes that they can use for the rest of their career. And also, if they want, they can send out CDs to concert presenters or to sources that they hope might commission them, and the CDs are a big value for them in that way. So I think they see a lot of worthwhile values in having the CDs released.
Well, thank you for all your support. I mean, it's an amazing thing. And people like you are few and far between.
That's true.
So
you have to be a little bit crazy.
Yes, exactly. So after the Todd Dockstader release in November, what's next for Starkland Records?
Well, I have several releases scheduled for next year in production. One is a composer named David Lee Myers, who lives in downtown New York, and he specializes in no-input music, in which you connect a bunch of processors or effects devices together, but there's no input. But if you turn up the various levels, something starts to come out, and it's really interesting. And he was sort of the first to do that, and he's put out other CDs, but I'm hoping that this CD will gain him the recognition that he deserves, because the music is different and interesting. And then I have another CD with Kathy Supove, who, as I'm sure you may know, is a prominent New York pianist, and she's playing a variety of new music. And I'm also working on a CD from the Naked Eye Ensemble, which is a new music ensemble that I connected with earlier this year. So there are a bunch of things in the works.
Great. Well, sounds like an exciting next year coming up for Starkland Records. I want to thank Thomas Steenland, founder and executive director of Starkland Records, for joining me today and talking about all this fantastic music, and for being just a huge supporter of contemporary music in America.
Well, thanks for having me, and I really appreciate your letting some people know about what I've been doing.